So following up a little bit on the talk I gave last week, in Buddhism there's often pairs of teachings that are considered to be kind of go together. And one of the classic important ones in Buddhist teachings is the is wisdom and compassion. And there are wisdom and compassion are sometimes called the wings of Buddhism, and it's kind of the wings that let your practice soar and fly, take off, is wisdom and compassion. If you only have one wing, you won't get off the ground. You need to have both, wisdom and compassion, wisdom and love, perhaps. And another one, which is could be connected to this, is the pair, the distinction between what's called conventional truth or reality and ultimate truth or ultimate reality. And Buddhist teachings becomes a lot clearer if we understand that this particular distinction between conventional truth and ultimate truth, ultimate reality. And if we understand this better, then it's easier to kind of discover the realms of wisdom and compassion, how they go together. So I wanted to talk a little bit today about conventional and ultimate reality and how it works. So one idea is that they're both called truths. There's conventional truth and ultimate truth. It's very clear that that's what's in Buddhism they talk about. So it isn't that conventional truth is bad or lesser than ultimate truth. They're both equally true, but often because we use the word ultimate, we think, well, ultimate is it's like is it Animal Farm when it ends up saying not Animal Farm, but, yeah, where he says everyone's equal, but some people are more equal than others. So all truths are equal, but the ultimate truth is a little bit more equal than conventional truth. So there's these two truths. And the conventional truth is the one where we tend to get into the most trouble, where it tends to be the one that causes the most suffering. And so that's where there's a lot of investigation and a lot of understanding. A lot of the wisdom in Buddhism has to do with understanding the nature of conventional reality, conventional truth, not to get rid of it, but so that we can be free of it and not get stuck in it. But it's possible to get stuck in ultimate truth too, but that's less a common experience than conventional truth. Now, conventional truth has to do with conventions, the conventions we choose for ourselves. And most of the reality we live in is built on conventions. And, you know, some things are really obvious and kind of very mundane. Our convention is to drive on the right side of the street. In places in the world where they do it wrong, they do it the left side of the street. The idea that, you know, left and right side of the street where you drive on, that's a convention, right? Just how they chose to do it in different places. There's nothing about the nature of the universe that says that this is ultimately has to be the way it is, you know, right, left side or whatever. And then to add on top of that a judgment that they're doing it wrong, I mean, that's adding another kind of a convention, a judgment, on top of what's a convention to begin with. It's kind of silly, right? It's just different people chose differently. And that's kind of, you know, maybe simplistic to point that kind of example out. But our reality is made up of infinite number, almost, of these kind of conventional distinctions that exist only through the collective mind of all of us. The fact that a red light, traffic light, means to stop, that's something we kind of have agreed together as a culture to do, or that we drive on the right side of the street. That's our understanding. It's the collective understanding of all of us that holds that convention in place. It could easily change, that convention. We could wake up tomorrow and decide, well, let's drive on the left side of the street. And those kinds of things we don't usually decide to change very quickly, but they're quite fluid. They could be changed. So, for example, there's a place I used to park in San Francisco for years, and probably since the street was put in, whenever it was put in, it's been unlimited parking, except the 2 hours a week for street cleaning. And that's a convention. You can park there however long you want. About a year ago, they decided that it's only two-hour parking there, so they changed the convention. However, I didn't notice, because I was living in the old convention, and the collective convention had changed. So I got a ticket. I was up there today, and I assumed it was a two-hour parking still. It was only a year ago, it was there before. And so I parked many blocks away where it was still unlimited parking, and walked to where I had to go. And when I came out of the building, I looked in the sign, and now it says 3 hours. So I could have parked there, I could have parked closer. So it's just a convention, you know, that we kind of create for ourselves. Now, after my newborn son was born, I was somewhat proudly telling a friend of mine about the kind of child-rearing theory I'm going to have. And I've learned a lot in the last 6 weeks about having ideals. And how, you know, ideals are ideals. But one of them, you know, was something my father told me about how he raised me. And so I thought this was a great idea, and I thought this is how I want to raise my son, and that was to offer as much support as he wanted, as he wants, and also as much independence as he wants. So if he comes back for support, support him, but if he wants to take the steps and have independence, let him take those steps and go out into the world. So to be there to offer support, but also to encourage, not exactly encourage, but allow for the independence also. That seemed like a nice, reasonable thing, maybe. And then I reflected on it, and even though it maybe seems like a nice, reasonable thing, that itself is also belongs to the world of conventions. That idea that we can be independent and we can cultivate independence as individuals. Even the idea of becoming individuals, individualistic, belongs to conventions of our culture. And there are other cultures in the world, and probably in Western culture 200-300 years ago, the idea of people becoming independent is a completely unheard of, ununderstandable concept. You're going to raise someone so they can become independent. It just didn't make any sense. It's like talking to them in Greek, if you use that kind of language. Because people had different conventions 200-300 years ago in the West about the nature of the self, the nature of how people are as individuals in relationship to others. And in some cultures, like in Japan, the understanding of what a self is is very different than ours. And the idea of the individual become independent is kind of a foreign idea, as I discovered when I was in Japan. And people who try to take the independent route in Japan don't get much support for it. And and here in the West, we're horrified by that. But it belongs to the conventions. And it doesn't necessarily have, you know, ultimate reality to it. But in our culture, certain things work and certain things don't. But it's just a convention. One example that I think I mentioned here a few weeks ago was the Buddhist attitude towards marriage, for example. People suffer a lot about our Western concept of marriage. When you're in the middle of a concept of such like marriage, it seems pretty absolute. You better not kind of mess with it. But it's just a convention that we've kind of constructed for ourselves, and it's probably being constructed as we speak in our culture. It's changing all the time what marriage means. But people kind of get locked in and think this is the way it has to be. But in other cultures, there's other radically different notions of what marriage should be or can be. And the Buddhist attitude is just to accept what's in the culture and not to have some absolute stance about what is right. Buddhism is very flexible with conventions. It goes with the conventions. If they don't hurt anybody, you go with the conventions. And so in countries where there is polygamy, and that's kind of common, cultures where they do that, Buddhism says, well, that's fine. And there's other cultures in Tibet, a few places in Tibet, where it's the opposite. What's the opposite?
Polyandry.
And that's the common, and so Buddhists came into that culture and said, fine, have all the husbands you want. And just, those are just conventions that we have, but it's very hard to see that all they are conventions. So already I'm kind of have the convention that I want to raise my son in. You know, I saw ideas about it. And I could see that he comes out, you know, he's there. And he's not exactly a blank slate, but he's pretty close to it. And he's kind of trying to construct the universe. He's looking and trying to make sense of it. And his parents are right there trying to help him make sense of it. And as we're helping him make sense of it, we're actually creating it for him. There was a study made of mothers, and apparently a very common phenomenon of mothers, I think all parents, is they start very early on interpreting the gestures and facial expressions of their children. Who knows if when, you know, sometimes it's kind of obvious he's distressed, But who knows sometimes, you know? I mean, I keep saying, look, he's smiling. And everybody else says, everybody, including the doctors and the nurses in the hospitals, they all kind of say, it's gas. You know. But, you know, so who knows what all these facial expressions are and what his experience is. But we're already putting him into concepts, into labels. And it's, you know, he doesn't pick up much now, but soon he will. And soon he realizes that certain kinds of behavior, certain kinds of expressions fit into kind of our conventions of what should happen. And his parents respond. Right now maybe he's just crying when he's distressed. But soon he's going to cry, you know, he's learning how to train us. He's training us as much as anybody else. And so as we grow up, we incorporate from our family and our society all these conventions about how to interpret our experience, how to be. And a huge percentage of how we choose to live our life and our emotional expressions and our feelings and our ideas about each other and who we are belongs to this realm called conventions. They're just a convention that we have in our culture here. And it's fascinating to read the history of the self. There's natural history books, you know, written about how the self has changed over the last, you know, since however long they have records. And what we take to be so absolute, sociologists, anthropologists, historians can see that's really a very changeable phenomenon, changes all the time. A lot of what we take as self, it comes out of comparative thinking. We're comparing ourselves to others. So, for example, a young child who grows up and the parents say, young boys don't cry. That young boy then is learning a concept of what it means to be a boy and what it means to be a man. That belongs to a convention. That is just a convention of our culture. There's other cultures have very different conventions where it's good to cry. And the men cry all the time. You go to Arab countries and men cry quite freely, apparently. In Japan, there was an article in the paper about Japan being the crying country. And they're all crying at the Olympics. Left and right, the Japanese are crying. And they just cry. It's just what they do.
And blow horns.
So we incorporate these things, but a lot of it is comparative thinking. So someone says, you're not good enough. You're not good enough. Good enough to what? So we learn we're unworthy or inadequate. Inadequate compared to what? We're full of shame. We're full of guilt. We're full of feeling that we're feeling the opposite. We feel like really proud of ourselves. We're the best. Best compared to what? A lot of the ideas of good, bad, right, wrong, worthy, unworthy, have to do with comparative thinking without necessarily understanding what we're comparing it to or even that we're comparing. And that's where it's so insidious, this idea of conventional truth, is we construct these things together and we don't understand the underlying arbitrariness or the optionality of the concepts that we run our life by. And a lot of the important work of mindfulness practice is to investigate the nature of our concepts, the nature of the ideas we base our life on, to understand the degree to which maybe they're just conventions and don't have any absolute value in and of themselves. They have value conventionally. If you drive on the left side of the street in America, that has consequences. It's still a convention. So we have conventions that we live by, but if you understand them as conventions, you can see them much more fluidly. So many cultures have jesters. And part of the function of jesters is they're usually people who have very sharp insight into the conventions that we live by. And they can see, you know, the holes in them, or they can see the quicksand that they're built upon. And they can kind of point that out to us and make fun of it. Great spiritual teachers, you know, or people who do meditation practice often can kind of see through the holes of the insubstantial concepts we have. They're quite insubstantial because the only place they exist is in the collective mind of all of us, right? They don't exist kind of like only in here. They exist because we've created together in this wherever the collective mind is. You know, good enough, bad enough. So what are the things that help us see through the conventions that we base our life on? Certainly I think meditation helps a lot. Sometimes something very jarring kind of wakes us up and we realize how we've been obsessing on certain things being really important. And it turns out that maybe in comparison to other things it's not so important. So death is a great teacher. If we get close to death or someone we know dies, And suddenly we kind of wake up and say, gee, I've been living in a dream. What I thought was really important is not important, you know. And we're kind of desperately trying to get this promotion and doing everything we can and forgetting our family and everything until someone in our family is dying. Forget that. I couldn't care less about that promotion. What I really care about is being with my loved ones while they're still alive. The convention... So there are various things that kind of pop the bubble of some of the ways we get caught by our conventions. But we do get caught. And getting caught creates a tremendous amount of suffering. Not being caught, to see the conventions for what they are, creates freedom. Now the self, that most of the ways in which we understand ourselves as a self, belongs to conventional thinking. It's a construct. However, we don't see it as being a construct. We don't see it as being conventional. We don't see the way that our parents kind of built up our conventional world. We don't see the step-by-step ways as children we kind of incorporate society's messages about what a self is. And so we just kind of see the done deal, in a sense. And it feels like a unitary, unified event, and solid and permanent and whatever. And we think this is the way the universe has to be. I'm an unworthy person. Right? The universe made me that, you know, the universe can't be wrong. This is what happened. It's just a convention of many of the ways in which we live. However, it isn't that this is bad and you should stop having a conventional sense of self. We have to have a conventional sense of self in order to live. And the conventional sense of self that we have has some truth to it. But it arises in convention the way we kind of are in discourse with each other, in relationship with each other. And so that's why I think a lot of people get very frightened or upset by the Buddhist teaching of no self. Because they say, wait a minute, if I don't have a self, how am I going to function properly? And then usually, sometimes Buddhist teachers will kind of discount the fear. But I think the fear is very real, because the conventional sense of who we think we are is dependent on the concepts and relationships we form and build with the society around us. And if you start taking away those relationships, our sense of self changes. Or if understanding those relationships change, or if our understanding of ourself changes, then the relationships change in some degree also. So it can be very frightening. Unless we firmly understand that conventions are conventions, they're kind of fluid, and they're kind of transparent, and they're kind of optional. And it's not the place to hang our hat. It's not the place to put absolute trust in. It's not the place to rely on totally and completely as if concepts and conventions are completely reliable. At the least, if you completely depend, the concepts don't change. At the least, you're going to get traffic. You're going to get a parking ticket occasionally. At the worst, you know, a lot more terrible things can happen to you if you're holding on to a particular conventional worldview, and the world has changed. Concepts are so fluid, since they're held in this nebulous area of the collective mind. The collective mind is nowhere. It's just, you know, everywhere. It's very fluid and can be changed from one day to the next. So, for example, the story. Maybe it's not a good example, but when I was in Burma, the Burmese government decided overnight to basically invalidate the 50 and 100 kyat notes. And there weren't really any notes higher than that. And a 50 kyat note was worth about a dollar in the black market. So most people had their money in these $1,500 notes, right? And so it's like most of us, you know, and you don't trust the bank, so you keep the money under your mattress. So imagine you didn't trust the banks in America and you had all your money in $20 bills. And you woke up one morning and the U.S. government said, sorry, the $20 bills are worthless. That would be, you know, in God we trust, it says on them. But money and dollar bills belong to the conventional world, and they don't have to stay the same, as I learned in Burma. They can change overnight. So if we put our trust, if we rely and depend on conventional reality, if our sense of who we are is dependent on the concepts that construct the sense of self, you're likely to suffer. And if your sense of self is based on comparative thinking, even more so. What Buddhism says on the other side of conventional truth is ultimate truth. And the relief from resting or relying on conventional reality is to get a sense, a taste of resting or taking refuge or living or something in this realm that's called ultimate reality, to have a sense of what that means. And to realize that that's much more our true nature, much more our one of the places we can live. It gives us a different perspective. If we really see the ultimate side, then it becomes a mirror to understand better how much conventional truth is just convention. But if you live in conventions all the time, it's very hard to see that that's all it is. It's like they say in England, if you don't leave England, you don't know England. If you don't leave the country you're in, you don't really get the good perspective of the country you're in. You're kind of insulated and you don't really see. If you don't have a chance to step outside of conventional reality, it's very hard to see what conventional reality is really like. And this is where, especially meditation practice, is very important, because it leads us eventually to a taste of what's the more ultimate truth, what's more ultimately possible to experience directly, unmediated by the concepts, unmediated by the conventions. There are other things going on in life besides our conventions. And so you can have a direct experience with that. And to begin seeing those things and connecting to them, to be in the world of our eyes and ears and nose and tastes, and to be in our primary senses and experience the world directly in the moment, belongs much more to the ultimate reality. To be lost in abstractions and ideas and thinking about the future and the past is to be lost in conventions. Every thought you have about the future, every thought you have about the past, is conventional thinking. It's a constructed thinking, because you construct certain ideas, perhaps with the hope or the fear that they might turn out that way. But you have no idea it's going to turn out that way. If you're thinking about what's happening tomorrow, you might say, well, I know that's going to happen. I'm going to have a job interview tomorrow at 8 o'clock in the morning, and that's going to happen, and I'm worried about it. You know, chances are you will if you have it set up, but you might not either. Until it actually happens, it remains in the world of construct, of conventions. Every thought you have about the future and the past belongs to conventional, constructed thinking. So to be in our primary senses, to experience reality directly, begins to loosen up the hard hold that conventions have. And it can offer a tremendous relief to those of us who are oppressed by the concepts we have, oppressed by the ideas we have of who we are, oppressed by the ways in which we've been indoctrinated by our family and society and culture and our own experiences about how we think we need to be or who we shouldn't be or the shoulds and shouldn'ts about ourselves. And to begin finding that it's possible to trust and rest more in the direct experience of the present moment cuts through a lot of this conventional kind of thinking. One aspect of conventional thinking, one aspect of ultimate truth, there's four aspects of it, but one aspect is the experience of nibbana. Nirvana, or enlightenment, is one of the things we can experience directly that has nothing to do with conventions. And in a sense, it's the experience of not clinging to anything, not desperately resisting anything. Because the world of conventions is a place, when we suffer in it, it's where a place where we tend to cling to things, or we push things away. We cling and we push away. And as we learn to trust and rest in ultimate reality more, as we learn to trust and rest, we learn it's possible, not necessary to cling to anything. Not clinging to anything doesn't mean we give up using conventional realities. Conventional truth is a truth. The ideas we have of ourselves is a truth. They're useful. It's useful to drive in the right side of the street in America. But we don't have to cling to it. We don't have to kind of say, you know, democracy is God in America, and we're going to kill and die for democracy. Democracy is ultimate value in America. It's like this ultimate thing, democracy, democracy, democracy. Let's export it to the whole world, democracy, you know, democracy. Democracy is just a concept, a collective concept, and the American version of it isn't very democratic even. Other countries have more democratic forms of democracy. And we kind of hold it up in this great abstraction. It's just a concept. And Americans are willing to die for this abstraction. So we suffer. So the idea is to hold it lightly. Not to let go of it. Not to kind of throw things away, the concepts and conventions. But we hold it with a light touch. And learning to hold conventions, hold reality with light touch, is a lot of the art of learning to live a free life, a life that's free of suffering and full of love. To hold things lightly and not to grasp. So nirvana is to experience totally and completely, without any remnants, the human possibility of a consciousness which has no movement towards grasping towards anything. That's completely open, open-handed in a sense, and allows things, everything just to rest as it is. And that's a very important experience for in Buddhism, a very important sense, is this idea of connecting with reality directly and then resting in the state of non-clinging and trusting that's okay. That if you don't cling to anything, if you don't resist anything, you can still take care of your life quite responsibly. It's kind of like if you're in rush hour traffic and you're stuck and there's no way to get through. You know, you don't need to get upset, right? Because you're going to get there just as soon if you get upset or if you don't. Upsetting is extra. So much of life is like that. You don't, there's a lot of things we can take care of things just fine without having to get upset or without having to cling, without having to insist it has to be that way. So if we can kind of begin to get a sense through meditation, through mindfulness, of how it is to be in contact with reality directly, unmediated by conventions, or even better, to rest in this experience of non-clinging, then we go back and we have a new perspective on conventions. And there's different perspectives, different kind of emotions or senses that might arise when you look back at the conventions we live our life by. One is you might start laughing. It's just totally ridiculous, some of the ways in which we live our lives and things we get caught up in and things we think are so important, and they're just kind of invented out of the blue and we take them to be so absolute. It's, you know, ludicrous and funny and humorous to see what we do. And we laugh kind of a little bit as adults. We look back sometimes at teenagers and say, well, you know, it's kind of cute what they're, you know, caught up in. But, you know, you're a teenager, you don't feel that way. So sometimes you look back and we think it can be kind of humorous to look at it. Another perspective is it's sad and makes you want to cry. The amount of suffering, the amount of pain we inflict on each other and on ourselves because we're really firmly attached and gripped by concepts and conventions is really, you know, it makes me want to break my heart sometimes. It's so arbitrary, you know. Why do we get caught up in these kinds of concerns? So we can laugh, we can cry, we can have equanimity, and we can also have compassion. And I think the experience, when we begin to experience reality directly, instead of being caught by the concepts, I think that a very loving heart is born and a very compassionate heart. And one of the qualities of freedom is the quality of love or compassion. The notions of being separate, separation from others, that belongs to the world of concepts, of convention. The notion, the idea that we're all the same and all united is also a convention. It's also a concept. The experience of just being alive is neither this nor that. It's neither being separate, nor is it being completely unified with everybody. But who said, you know, it's neither this nor that is a famous expression in Buddhism. Neither this nor that. But what is it? I don't know, but we can experience it. And from that experience, that neither separate nor united, is born a wonderful kind of compassion and love, a wonderful appreciation, and a wonderful caring for each other. And it's the kind of caring that maybe T.S. Eliot, famous quote of a line that I like to quote a lot from the Four Quartets, where he says, "Teach me to care and not to care." So it isn't that we don't care about the concepts and our friends and everything, but don't care about it, you know. Teach me to care and not to care. Teach me to be concerned but not caught up in it. Or as the Diamond Sutra says, the famous Buddhist sutra, it says something like, I don't remember the quote too well, it says something like, You should go out and save all beings without any notion that there are living beings. Neither this nor that. So we're completely dedicated toward the welfare of all beings everywhere. But really, there are no beings anywhere. Beings are just a conventional idea. So anyway, does all that make sense to you? But part of the inspiration for this talk was to encourage you not to investigate conventional reality. And this is really one part of mindfulness practice, is not to take it for granted, but really to investigate and study. What are the belief systems? What are the concepts? What are the notions and ideas I have about reality, about society, about friendship, about all kinds of things? Where do they come from, and how absolute are they? And, you know, are they? And then to begin to kind of maybe feel a little bit looser about it, because it's just convention. Yeah.
There's a conventional truth that has been caught, and that is the usual manner of having children. So then, when I think of cloning, I start to go into the future, you know, as you're saying, and I'm caught, because I think of Brave New World and Aldous Huxley, and I have fears and concerns, and it's hard for me to think lightly about it in an ultimate truth kind of way.
Well, I think that the challenge, that's the challenge. And how some people might react is that they'll hear this kind of teaching and say, well, I'm not going to think about these kinds of issues, because that's thinking about the future, it's thinking about concepts. I'm just not going to be involved in that at all, forget it, you know. And that's somewhat irresponsible. I think the idea is to take these things responsibly, think about it, and be concerned about it, and maybe give a lot of thought to it and a lot of research and whatever. But there's no need to be afraid. There's no need to cling. There's no need to have resistance. We're just engaged fully. So that's where the investigation then turns inward. It doesn't so much look at the concepts, maybe it looks at our fear. Looks at our reactions and our reactions, and tries to understand them, and tries to find some way to be responsibly involved without the motivation of fear or anger or those things. Yes?
Can you repeat those four components of...
Ultimate reality? What can be experienced as ultimate reality are four things. It's what's called the primary sensations. It's usually four. The four, the earth, water, fire, and air. Sensations of hardness, coolness, movement, temperature, heat, you know, things like that. Kind of the primary sensations we have. That's the one. The other is... consciousness itself, awareness itself, is considered to be something you can experience directly without any mediation of concepts. And the third is what's called mental factors, or states of mind. And you can, you know, look at my son, you know, and he doesn't know any concepts as far as I can tell yet, and he has mental factors galore. He has mental states, you know, like fury and delight. And today I think he had the first official smile. He kind of looked at me and he was really smiling. You know, so he had delight, you know. And he doesn't have any concept of what that is, but you can experience certain emotions directly, unmediated by concepts. And the fourth one is nirvana, the experience of awakening or freedom. Yes. Well, some of the jhanic factors, the jhanic factors are mental factors. So the joy and equanimity of and the concentration of the jhanic factors can be experienced directly. Except for nirvana, the other three ultimate truths or ultimate realities are constructed realities. They arise and pass because of the conditions coming together to create them. So a mental state arises because different situations come together. And so the jhanic experiences are constructed and conditioned phenomena, and are not the same thing as nirvana, which is unconditioned.
possible to think about the future in a present way?
Yes.
So that...
If you're thinking about the future, thinking about the future always occurs in the present. Right? You cannot think about the future tomorrow. I mean, you can, but, you know, you always think in the present when you're thinking about the future or the past. If you realize you're thinking about the future, then you're in the present. You can continue thinking about the future, but you're not fooled. So when we say be here now, which we might say sometimes, naively this person might take that to mean, you know, stop thinking about the past and the future. But more subtly what it means is just remain, be aware of what's going on in the present. And if you're thinking about the future, just be aware you're doing that in some simple way. One of the conventions we have is to stop at 9. It's just a convention. We don't have to. So look, study your conventions. You'll be surprised how many you find that you not only live under, but suffer under. Thank you.